From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
It can't succeed unless there's a partnership between a president and a Congress, so that what is done can't be reversed very easily.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Paul Ray, our first guest on today's program, talking about reversing the nanny state. Dr. Ray is professor of history, Charles O. Lee and Louise K. Lee chair in the Western Heritage, and member of the graduate faculty here at Hillsdale College. We talked at length with Dr. Ray about the nanny state in the U.S. and efforts to roll it back. Dr. Ray, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You're also the author of the book Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift, which is on point with what we discussed today, which is the nanny state. This is a phrase, a term that many people have heard or perhaps have even used. How do you define that phrase, nanny state?
Well, the welfare state is a nanny state, and it involves us ceding to the government a great deal of power over our lives in return for a promise that our welfare from cradle to grave will be looked after by a benevolent government. It's a natural outgrowth, at least I argue in that book, of something that comes with commercial democracy. And what comes with commercial democracy is, well, a couple of things. One, the commercial side. The fact of the matter is that commercial societies are dynamic, that there are economic ups and downs, there are recessions, depressions, there are periods of great prosperity. There's also technological change. You start off working in one job, and literally the job is eliminated by technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to retool and do something else. All of this means is, on the one hand, we know a prosperity that no one in human history before us has known. And on the other hand, we live in a situation of insecurity, just simple insecurity. Which is to say, things are changing all around you. This, to some degree, goes with the territory of commercial democracy. And therefore, the desire to have somebody else take responsibility for your welfare is very great. That's one side to it. Another side to it is, in a world in which everyone is equal, people have a very powerful sense of their weakness, of the lack of leverage,
mm-hmm.
of their lack of political influence. Everything is dominated by big corporations, by big labor unions, by government powers.
Dr. Paul Ray with us. So in your book, Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift, what did you set about to do?
I went back to look at some of the great thinkers that that very early in the period of the emergence of modern commercial republican or quasi-republican regimes, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and Tocqueville. I was writing about them more generally, and I discovered as I was working my way through them that they have certain themes in common. And one of them is summed up in the word inquietude. On the one hand, it means restlessness, restiveness. In another way, it means disquiet. And it's a religious word. At the beginning of Augustine's Confessions, he said, we will not rest until we rest in thee. And the Latin is inquietum, which is inquietude. And it's picked up by the Jansenist, by Pascal, and it is made quite thematic in Pascal. And these French writers who come after Pascal are all imbued with this sort of thinking. From Pascal's perspective, inquietude is a reflection of the fall, original sin, And we long for something we don't have, paradise, a close connection with God, and so forth. And Locke translates three of these essays into English. I mean, he's really involved with the sort of the Jansenists there. And he takes over from Pascal via Nicole this word enquietude. And it's the most important term in his essay concerning human understanding.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is what Pascal and Pierre Nicole treat as a consequence of the fall, Locke treats as fundamental to the nature of man. We're always restless.
Mm. And how does Montesquieu enter the picture here?
Montesquieu picks this up, and he takes a different view from Locke. He doesn't think enquietude describes the French monarchy or ancient Greece and Rome. It describes England.
Mm.
The accusation he makes is that Locke has assumed everyone's just like the English. And he ties it to the character of the English regime, to the commercial character of England, the ups and downs, but also to the political ups and downs. On the one hand, he greatly admires England. On the other hand, he's not sure that England produces tranquility of mind. And he identifies liberty with a tranquility of mind that arises from a sense of one's own security. You may be, in fact, be more secure in England, but you don't feel it.
Mm.
Rousseau comes along, and he reverses the polarities. He's hostile to commercial society, but he takes over Montesquieu's analysis. And what he's fascinated by is fashion. And the dominance of fashion within commercial societies and the manner in which fashion gets in the way of actually thinking. The danger is that everyone thinks the same ridiculous thoughts alike under a kind of tyranny of fashion. Tocqueville picks this up, and he looks at America, and he thinks America is the most restless people in the world. They're always moving. They build a house for their retirement, and before they've got the roof over the house, they've sold it and they've gone on to do something else. And he uses the word enquietude, as does Rousseau. But he is also concerned with the manner in which our sense of weakness and the ups and downs of commerce and politics creates a desire to have somebody else take care of things. And he says the Americans know how to counteract this. One is deep religious commitment. The second is local self-government, where you're actually an agent and you discover that you're not weak, you have power. And you discover also the art of association through local self-government, so you can magnify your power by cooperating with other people. And he says the Americans found civic associations to do everything that in France is done by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And they find a kind of tranquility of spirit in their families.
Are you at all optimistic about a stoppage, or even better, a reversal of those natty state type policies?
Not very. It can't succeed unless there's a partnership between a president and a Congress, so that what is done can't be reversed very easily. I'm not especially sanguine about this. Look, things are happening that one could not imagine. So it could be that the despotism that is in our future is not going to be soft at all. Mm. Not at all.
Dr. Paul Ray, Professor of History, Charles O. Lee and Louise K. Lee Chair in the Western Heritage, and author of Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift. Thank you for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Up next, Brian Christian, author of The Most Human Human, will join us to talk about the future of AI, artificial intelligence. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Remember, you can find out more about Hillsdale and its work at hillsdale.edu. Joining us now on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Brian Christian. He's the author of The Most Human Human and Algorithms to Live By. He was recently on Hillsdale College's campus for a CCA lecture series on artificial intelligence, specifically discussing the gaps and overlaps between humans and machines. Brian, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So it's a phrase that many are familiar with, but let's get your definition. When we talk about AI, what is artificial intelligence?
Well, there's the joke in the field that artificial intelligence is everything that computers can't do yet. And you do sort of see this progression as these milestones have been passed over the years. You know, we saw, for example, in the late 90s, IBM's Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov at chess. And suddenly we say, well, that's not really artificial intelligence. That's just a lot of calculating power. It feels to me, though, that we are truly on the brink of what seems inarguably, in my view, to be, artificial general intelligence, that we now have systems that can perceive objects in their environment. They can deal with natural language. They can move around in a 3D physical environment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these ideas have been around since the 1940s, and they're inspired very directly by neuroscience and psychology. And so I think we're really at a thrilling and perhaps harrowing moment where some of these ideas that have been around for now almost a century are finally bearing fruit, and we really are having these systems that can interact and perceive flexibly in their environment.
You mentioned kind of neuroscience there. Does this continued development of AI give us a better opportunity to learn even more about the human nature?
Absolutely, that is the case. And for me, that's, I think, one of the most satisfying aspects of it, that we're now in year 80 or so of this project to build these machines in our own image. And both the ways that we've failed to do that and the ways that we've succeeded alike have taught us something about what it actually is to be human, to be intelligent, to have a mind. One of the most dramatic of these was in the late 1990s, there was a lot of neuroscientific work on dopamine, mm-hmm. and people were confused. It sort of looks like reward, but it's not exactly reward. What's going on? And it was actually the artificial intelligence community that came along and saw their data, and they said, that looks exactly like what we would call a temporal difference prediction error, and it turns out that's exactly what it was. And so not only are you having this kind of convergence between the neuroscience and the AI, each is now helping to accelerate the other. And so I think it's pretty remarkable.
You wrote, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, that no matter how many interactions that an AI would have or AI would have with a human, humanity is impossible to replicate. If that's the case, should we see AI as a threat, or what is there a threat to humanity from AI?
I think there are a few things to be worried about, honestly. And I think it's worth taking that concern seriously. I mean, I think the biggest thing to be concerned about is simply that we are deploying these systems that are potentially very powerful, that have very subtle societal effects. And they don't necessarily seem like the kind of thing we should be freaked out about. You know, we're freaked out about the picture of the T-2000 with the
right.
machine guns and the skeleton eyes and so forth. But we're not really worried about, let's say, a facial recognition system or a system that filters resumes by relevance for an employer. But even systems that seem kind of as boring and bureaucratic as those really do have an effect on society. They affect, you know, who gets mortgages, who gets bail,
right.
who gets their resume seen by an employer and can get a job. And so I think we're already at the brink of a real ethical, maybe crisis isn't putting it too strongly, where these machine learning models that are just trained on these heaps of statistical data are affecting people in the real world. And we need to think, I think, much more carefully about exactly how those systems are built if they're going to be affecting millions of people.
You wrote, too, if computers are so good at mathematics, as an example, does it in some sense take away an arena of human activity, or does it free us from having to do a non-human activity? It's been a few years since you
yes.
wrote that.
Yeah.
Have you thought more? Where do you come down on that? What do you think?
I do think that perhaps, you know, if you look through the history of Western philosophy, there's been, in my view, an overemphasis on these very sort of left-brain analytical abstract thought processes. And I think we've, in a way, given short shrift to the sorts of capacities that we share with animals, the ability to move around fluidly in an environment, sense and perceive the real world, you know, run and jump and recognize our friend's face and shake their hand and exchange a few words. There's an incredible amount of complexity that's happening, even in these more sort of animal, if you want to think of it, ways. And I think artificial intelligence is now forcing us to recognize the true complexity of a lot of these things that we just sort of take of as the fundamental ground floor of being a person. And so having that appreciation, I think, only deepens the experience when you realize just how incredibly and marvelously complicated even what seems like a normal interaction really is. I think it's eye-opening.
In The Most Human, you wrote about your experience in trying to fool, right, or competing against a computer, right? And something that you wrote about was the advice to just be yourself, to just be
right.
Human. Does AI make that more difficult when we see, you know, we're texting and we see the words complete, or Gmail now has the automatic replies to people? Is it tougher to be yourself?
I truly think it is, actually. And I see this as a real challenge for anybody that, you know, one of the oldest ideas in computer science is what's called the Turing test, which is the idea that, you know, if you're having one conversation with a person and the other with a machine that's trying to sound like a person, it's going to get harder and harder to tell the difference. And I think it really is getting harder to tell the difference. And no small part of that is exactly what you said, which is that now when we're using, whether it's email or text, we are essentially operating through a computational model of language that is kind of nudging us towards more typical ways of writing things. And it makes it easier to type with our thumbs, which are too big to hit the keys. But on the other hand, it pushes us towards a smaller vocabulary or a more sort of impoverished syntax. And for me, both as a writer and also just as a human, I feel like we need to be vigilant and try to interact in ways that capture as much of that richness as possible, and not just go down the level of, you know, what can I peck with my thumbs, and if the computer corrects it, okay, that's close enough. I think there is a danger there.
Final question for Brian Christian, a little more real world. Maybe it's just me noticing this, but when people interact with AI, with chatbots or with those sorts of things, it seems to me they become more frustrated and agitated than they would with an actual human, even if the answers would be the same, right? Do you think that tells us something about the future of AI and how it might be used?
I worry, in a way, that AI will be so much cheaper than human labor that even though it's really frustrating and annoying, you're still going to have to deal with your AI customer service representative instead of a human customer service representative. But even in that sort of grim scenario, I feel like the silver lining is still that it's teaching us what to appreciate and the things that we perhaps took for granted. And now AI gives us a way of seeing that, I think, with fresh eyes. And that, to me, is really encouraging.
Brian Christian, author of The Most Human, and Algorithms to Live By. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's my pleasure.
Up next, Flannery O'Connor's birth date is March 25th. So around that anniversary, we talk with Michael Jordan about the author. I'm Scott Bertrand. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Do you come alive in the great outdoors? Do you love to hunt, fish, or cruise the lake every chance you get? See it all at the Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 24th and 5th at the Reading Civic Auditorium. All you could possibly want or need to gear up for the outdoors with over 150 exhibitors. From apparel to hunting, fishing, boating, camping, kayaking, mountain biking, off-road utility equipment, just to name a few. Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 24th and 5th at the Reading Civic Auditorium. Something for the whole family. Axe throwing, Euro bungee. Enjoy the beer garden with a variety of food. Win thousands in prize giveaways. $7 admission, 12 and under are free. Sunday, we honor our veterans with free admission all day. For CDC social distancing and masks recommended. Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 24th and 5th. Go to www.readingsportsmansexpo.com for more information. Presented by Jefferson State Adventure Hub, Crown Motors, and Reading Yamaha and Sea-Doo.
Alan Gordon, Coach Master Collision. Although Coach Master is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and there is no better time to get screened than right now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Did you know that the City of Reading has started licensing commercial cannabis activities within the city limits? Synergy is the first of the city's approved retailers to obtain licensure, bringing to the Reading area the most experienced retailer in the North State. They will ensure that your visit is both professional and comfortable. Access is simple and discreet. Synergy has a private 25-space parking lot at the back of the building. Synergy is located at 345 Hempstead Drive, Reading.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. March 25th, 1925 was the birth date of Flannery O'Connor. So this week we talk further about the American novelist, short story writer, essayist, with Michael Jordan, professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Very glad to be back.
And we are back to talk a little more about the author Flannery O'Connor. Last time we talked about her fiction. This time we talk about essays, lectures, criticism. We did talk previously in a segment about Flannery O'Connor, but for those who missed it or have not gone back in the archives to find it yet, just tell us very briefly what they should know about Flannery O'Connor as we start this conversation.
Flannery O'Connor was a novelist and short story writer. She's very much in the limelight as a major Southern writer. Her work is translated in many languages. There are Flannery O'Connor groups and study clubs. So she's very much an author worth reading and celebrated as one of the greats.
Classified normally under the Southern Gothic style, how would you describe that style under which her work is often classified?
She herself objected to the almost any kind of classification. She said in one of her lectures that if you are from the South, you are going to be put into the school of Southern degeneracy. And you're classified in this way, and she resisted that classification. However, the school of Southern degeneracy or the Southern Gothic is a kind of writing that features violence, the grotesque, man dehumanized rather than elevated into his highest mode. And her fiction does qualify for that, but she did resist the label. She also did not like the label that she was a Southern writer. She is, but her Southern writing transcends the South because she's dealing with universal concerns. She did not like to be thought of as a woman writer, you know, so she is resistant to the classification. But I do think it's fair to say that her work does share some affinity with what's called the school of the Southern Gothic. And that would be William Faulkner at the highest level, and then Erskine Caldwell at a lower level.
What made her such a great literary critic in her own right?
Well, I do believe that she is her own best critic.
Yes.
It's astonishing how much she did write in her lectures, her essays, and then, of course, in her letters about her own fiction. So she says a great deal about her intentions, what she is up to, how her stories work. This is not necessary, but that is to say, her fiction achieved acclaim and renown before people began to understand exactly what she was up to.
You say she was her own best critic. Do you see her through her works learning from herself and adjusting and doing things differently in subsequent writings?
In one instance, I certainly do. That one instance that does come to mind. She wrote and commented, her fiction is full of the grotesque, of freaks and sinners and bent and distorted humanity. And in her early remarks about the grotesque, she linked the grotesque to original sin. She says that the freak or the grotesque figure in literature is disturbing to us because he reminds us of our displacement.
Mm-hmm.
She says that the reason writers in the American South were able to recognize the freak in literature or the grotesque in literature is because they had a conception of the whole man. So there is a theological dimension to this, but the point is that initially she does focus on the grotesque as a evidence of a negative or a fallen condition.
Mm-hmm.
Later in her life, and this is when she writes her memoir of Mary Ann, but what she says in this later comment on the grotesque is that even the good has aspects of the grotesque in it. That we are, people are goods under construction, and even the goodness that we have is somehow tainted. So there's a little more of a positive view.
Talking with Dr. Michael Jordan about Flannery O'Connor's essays and lectures. During her life, she wrote more than 100 book reviews for 2 Catholic newspapers covering serious theological works. How does that reveal her intellectual life beyond, you know, her fiction writing?
It is astonishing how much she read and how well read she was. Her library holdings, she had a well-stocked library, and she did like to focus on biblical, theological, and religious studies, as well as works of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, she does review actually 130 works for her diocesan magazine, and most of those, or the majority of those, do focus on religious, biblical, and theological studies. She's certainly familiar with the older writers and theologians, Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas. I think I mentioned in the last interview that she said many people think that she was a hillbilly nihilist, and she said, I would like to be known as a hillbilly Thomist. So she reads St. Thomas. She knows him well. She's read Augustine, St. John of the Cross. But in addition to those older theologians, Gabriel Marcel, Martin Buber, Teilhard de Chardin, Karl Barth, Etienne Gilson, Kierkegaard, the list goes on.
She also gave several lectures. She wrote some essays about the art of writing. How did she think that one ought to teach literature?
O'Connor says that she cut her teeth on the new criticism of that era that was promoted and featured by John Crow Ransom, Robert Penn Warren, Alan Tate, and others. And this was a way of looking at literature that would say that you need to look at the work of literature as a by itself. Mm. So you want to study, say, The Scarlet Letter. You shouldn't start reading about Hawthorne and his biography, or the world of the Puritan era.
Mm-hmm.
You look at The Scarlet Letter and you read it carefully. So a close, she would advise readers to give a close attention to the work itself, and to see in the work, and not imported from outside, the autobiographical details, sociological details of the era. She looks at a work of literature as primarily as it's a work of art, and it is, it's got its rules, its limitations, its conventions.
Dr. Michael Jordan, professor of English at Hillsdale College, talking about Flannery O'Connor's essays and lectures. We look forward to a return trip for one final interview about Flannery O'Connor. Dr. Jordan, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Up next, from Hillsdale's Philosophy Department, we talk with Ian Church about the philosophy of luck. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Do you come alive in the great outdoors? Do you love to hunt, fish, or cruise the lake every chance you get? See it all at the Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 24th and 5th at the Reading Civic Auditorium. All you could possibly want or need to gear up for the outdoors, with over 150 exhibitors. From apparel to hunting, fishing, boating, camping, kayaking, mountain biking, off-road utility equipment, just to name a few. Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 24th and 5th at the Reading Civic Auditorium. Something for the whole family. Axe throwing, Euro bungee, enjoy the beer garden with a variety of food. Win thousands in prize giveaways. $7 admission, 12 and under are free. Sunday, we honor our veterans with free admission all day. For CDC social distancing and masks recommended. Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 24th and 5th. Go to www.readingsportsmansexpo.com for more information. Presented by Jefferson State Adventure Hub, Crown Motors, and Reading Yamaha and Sea-Doo.
Aloha, this is Kevin, operations manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price, and after a few months, realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR 1460 AM or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcasts through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time. You get me
every time. Anyone can be tested for COVID-19, and same-day appointments are often available. Average turnaround time is between 2 and 3 days. Testing is critical to help contain the spread of COVID-19. It is vital to know if a person has the virus so they can remain isolated until they're no longer contagious. This helps keep case numbers low. We need our case rate and positivity rates to drop so we can move into a less restrictive tier. And testing is a way we can all help with that. You can make an appointment at lhi.care/COVID testing.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the show. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Ian Church, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Hillsdale College. Dr. Church, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Talking today about a subject you've written on and edited on as well, the philosophy of luck. What does academic research into luck look like?
Well, there are a couple different ways to approach the topic of luck in terms of academic research. We might pursue a theoretical research program, or we might approach that topic more empirically. A theoretical approach might focus on thought experiments or special cases that might tell us a little bit more about the nature of luck and its broader import. And along these lines, we might start thinking about different theories for luck or theories of luck. So is luck primarily about risk? Mm-hmm. Is luck primarily about probability? Is luck something that should be understood modally in terms of how philosophers frequently put these things? And then there are other, you know, along these lines, we might think about luck, about whether or not it's going to be tracking our intuitions across various cases, right? We intuitively say that there's an element of luck in these cases. So, you know, does our account of luck match those intuitions? And we might also try to develop a theory that will allow us to distinguish between different types of luck. And so there's capacity, epistemic luck, content luck, environmental luck, veridic luck, all sorts of fun and exciting things that we talk about in the book. But as I said, we might also explore some of these issues by leaving the armchair, so to speak. We might try to develop a better understanding of luck or an understanding of our understanding of luck via empirical research. So we might want to explore when and why people assign luck to certain events. We might want to see what sort of characteristics are required in order for people to attribute luck to a particular situation. And, you know, we might want to see how the presence of luck impacts our willingness to attribute blame or praise to some whatever situation we're talking about.
Are we talking about a slightly different definition than what people would use in everyday parlance? I can perhaps hear someone say, how can you study luck? It's mere happenstance anyway. There's no rhyme, nor reason, nor pattern. So when we talk about luck, is it in a different way than perhaps we'd use it in an everyday usage?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. And I'd say that in general, a lot of the academic literature has tried to explore luck in such a way that's at least broadly compatible or faithful to our everyday way of using the word luck. So we might commonly call a particular scenario, if we call a particular scenario lucky, we might be, you know, the philosophers, for example, will want to say something about, you know, why that particular account matches our theories. Or if we don't think it matches our theories, we might want to say, well, what's going wrong here? Is there some sort of heuristic or bias or some sort of psychological mechanism that's making it appear to us as if it's lucky, but in actual fact, we know for whatever reason that it's not. But in general, we try to remain faithful to the everyday usage. Now, one way where you know, the way the academics talk about luck is different from our everyday usage, at least in literature that I'm primarily engaged with, is that, you know, in our everyday usage, we talk about, you know, good luck or bad luck. Mm-hmm. But, you know, within the epistemological literature in particular, we might focus more on just the presence of luck, full stop, right? The degrees of luck, good or bad. And so we're not really as focused on the good or bad luck, but just the presence of luck at all.
When this topic is discussed, where does the element of control enter the equation when we discuss luck?
Yeah, so that's central. Another great question. And so within the ethics literature in particular, it's really common to think of control as being intimately connected with appropriate attributions of praise and blame, such that if you do something that's outside of your control, then you can't be praised for it or blamed for it. So if I'm the getaway driver for a bank robbery, but I only participated because someone has a gun to my head, well, then I can't be blamed for that because it was outside of my control. And so, likewise, we might think that's going to be connected with luck because, if I scored the winning basket at a basketball game, but only by tripping over my own feet and I threw the basketball into the air, I shouldn't be praised for that because it wasn't really within my control. But likewise, if something terrible happens due to no intent of my own, just sort of a fluke accident, we might think that I shouldn't be blamed for that if that's outside of my control because it was just a matter of luck. And so this raises some important questions and the issue of the problem of moral luck within the ethics literature. So let's imagine a scenario where we have two people, A and B, and we're giving them these names because philosophers are frequently not that creative. But A and B are in identical scenarios. Let's say that A and B are both drinking too much at a party, and they both make the terrible decision to still drive home after the party. A takes his route home, and it's pretty uneventful, makes it home. B, let's say, again, taking very similar roads, everything else is the same, but on B's journey home, due to outside of his control, a child happens to dart out in front of him. Reaction time, he's unable to stop, right? So A gets home, B does not get home without incident. But nevertheless, we want to say that our intuitions are strongly to say that B is far more blameworthy than A. But that's a bit of a puzzle because the child could have darted in front of A, but it just didn't happen to happen to A. And it did. And the child did dart in front of B, but again, this was outside of B's control. So even though there's the salient difference here is outside of their control, nevertheless, it seems as though we want to assign more blame in the case of B than in A. And so a lot of philosophical literature has focused on, okay, what do we want to make of these kinds of cases between sort of distinguishing them? Should we be equally blameworthy in both cases, or should we, is there an important reason to say that one is more blameworthy than the other?
Talking to Dr. Ian Church, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Hillsdale College, about the philosophy of luck. What is the Gettier problem, and why is it significant?
So Edmund Gettier wrote a famous paper in 1963 called Is Justified True Belief Knowledge? And it's a legendary paper. It's the paper that all academics dream of writing. It's 2.5 pages long, and it changes the field forever. And so in that paper, what he did is that he pointed out that, various figures within the academic literature, arguably going back to Plato, assume that knowledge has three parts, truth, justification, and belief. But then he went on to show that you can have a justified true belief that nevertheless fails to be knowledge. And so as such, we might wonder if the justified true belief definition of knowledge is complete, or is there something missing from it? So let me give you an example that's in line with what Gettier proposed. So I like to go to Scotland pretty frequently, and let's say I'm on a trip to Scotland and I'm at a bed and breakfast, and it's an idyllic bed and breakfast, and I try to find a place with sheep because that seems appropriate in a Scottish bed and breakfast. And I wake up in the morning and I've been told by the owner of the B&B that there might be sheep in the area, and I'm just delighted by this. And so I wake up in the morning, throw open the curtains, and so groggily, I look outside and I think, there's some sheep, right? But unbeknownst to me, it turns out that what I'm seeing is merely a sheep-shaped rock. And so my belief looks like is you know it's lucky that I or it's unlucky that we should say that I'm forming this belief when I'm looking at a sheep-shaped rock. But also unbeknownst to me, on the other side of the hill, there are indeed sheep in that field. And so this is an example of a belief that I have. It turns out that it's true. And seemingly justified, seeing something that looks like a sheep is reason to give you, it's a reason to believe that there's a sheep. So I have a justified true belief that nevertheless, intuitively you might think, fails to be knowledge.
We've alluded to this, this book that you've edited, appropriately titled The Philosophy of Luck. What's inside and what can people expect if they decide to pick it up?
Yeah, so the handbook it was first published in 2019 in hardback and now just recently came out in paperback, which is much cheaper and so much more suitable for an eventual stocking stuffer if you're interested. but it was co-edited with my friend Bob Hartman, and he specializes more on the moral luck side of things. I'm more on the epistemology side of things. 39 articles in all. It's a great gift.
If you price it out per article, it's really a bargain.
That's right, exactly. You can't afford not to do it.
Ian Church, Dr. Ian Church, Assistant Professor of Philosophy here at Hillsdale College, talking about the philosophy of luck. Dr. Church, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Paul Ray, talking about the nanny state. Brian Christian on the future of AI. Michael Jordan from Hillsdale's English department talked about Flannery O'Connor, and we heard Ian Church on the philosophy of luck. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Turtle Bay Exploration Park is back open for exploration. See the West Coast Biennial Art Exhibition featuring diverse pieces by artists up and down the West Coast. Enjoy the visible river aquarium, caverns exhibits, parrot playhouse, and more. There's something for everyone to discover at Turtle Bay.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6:05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6:05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuente's Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
As restrictions continue to be lifted in Shasta County, many businesses are set to reopen, and KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and KCNR1460.com wants to help spread the word. So, if you are reopening your business, planning on opening a business for the first time, or are already open for business, KCNR has many advertising packages to choose from. Give us a call at 530-605-4565 and talk to a KCNR representative today. That's 530-605-4565.
I expect it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit. My family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
Turtle Bay Spring Plant Sale coming up on Saturday, April 3rd. Members and non-members will enjoy discounts on regular nursery prices. California native and climate acclimated plants from all around the world, primed to grow strong and healthy right in your own backyard. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
By reading a lot of novels in a variety of genres and asking questions, it's possible to learn how things are done, the mechanics of writing, so to speak, and which genres and authors excel in various areas. Nicholas Sparks.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our question for today in our continued Frequently Asked Questions series is, how do you know which genre your book is in?
See, the book I'm writing right now has magic, but it also takes place on Earth, and some of the problems are solved by a character falling in love, and most of the stuff that happens is action-based, where people are sword fighting and trying to kill each other. So is it fantasy? Is it historical? Is it romance? Or is it action-adventure?
Swords and sorcery.
Which is a subcategory of...
fantasy. Which is a subcategory of speculative fiction.
Which is a subcategory of fiction.
So, as you can see, there is a lot of things in genre. But there are a couple of questions that you can ask yourself to help you narrow down what genre your book is in.
Before we get into that, I want to make sure you, our audience, knows why this question is important. Well, I'm not asking this question. I know what genre my book is in. Or I don't care what genre my book is in. It's very dangerous for people who want to be career authors. If all you are doing is writing selfishly, you don't have to worry about genre. You have fun. We'll see you next episode. But if you ever want to sell any of your books, understanding your genre, understanding which shelf the bookstore puts it on, helps sell your book. Because if I am looking for an action-adventure novel and I have to sift through cookbooks, then I'm not going to be as interested.
So if you want to know why you need to know, go back in our archives and search for target audience. We've talked about that before in an episode, I believe, in July. You can also look at our series from last March when we talked specifically about genres. We covered the basic ones, some of the specifics of, you know, cover design and plot of each of those. Today, though, we're not focusing on those aspects. We're just focusing on how to figure out what genre you're in.
Yeah, if you don't know which of March's episodes to look at to make sure it applies to your book, this is the right episode to start on.
So what is the first question that you need to ask yourself in order to figure out what genre you're in?
Is my book fiction or nonfiction? Fiction is defined as more or less false. Something that did not happen, you are not trying to convince anybody that it did happen. I am not trying to convince anybody that there is a conspiracy of vigilantes in my hometown. Nobody is trying to be sold on that idea. But if there were, here's a fun story that surrounds them. Nonfiction would be more of your self-help, your biography.
Memoirs. So if it actually happened, or if it's almost all based on true story, you are writing nonfiction. If you are writing fantastical things that you made up in your head, or things that are loosely based on what actually happened, you are writing fiction.
Technically, fairy tales and allegories fall into the fiction category. Those are the ones that you want people to understand and think about, but they aren't something that actually happened.
A sub-question of fiction or nonfiction is, what's the age range of the book? Are you writing for children? Are you writing for middle grade? Are you writing for young adults? Are you writing for adults?
Understanding that helps the bookstore put the book in the right location. Because if I'm writing about cats that all have this secret life after they leave the house in the morning, they go out and have adventures and then they come back home and then sleep in their beds, your kids might love that story.
Your adults, not so much.
They're not going to be as intrigued.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.